Hello, 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 and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates, and nature stories from the professionals to you. Snot, poo, and fart. These things, in my opinion, will always be funny. That's just a fact. But what else can we learn from them? On this week's episode, I speak with author and conservationist Danny Rabbiotti. After writing three books, Does It Fart, True or Poo, and Believe It or Snot, Danny knows all about the gross side of nature and how it can grab people's attention. Danny has also completed a PhD looking into the effects of climate change on African wild dogs, specifically their behaviour. We talk about what has changed and what is being done to save these incredible animals. Finally, a quick chat on climate change itself. We ask the question, can all animals, including ourselves, adapt quick enough to be able to survive? Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hi Danny, thanks so much for joining me on an episode of Into the Wild. How are you doing? Are you all good?
Yeah, I'm pretty good, thanks.
Good, good.
Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. No, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. First of all, just for the benefit of my listeners around the world, can you just tell us a bit about who you are and what is it you do?
My name's Danny. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the Zoological Society of London, and I research the impact of climate change on African wild dogs. And on top of that, I'm also an author of kind of gross and humorous animal-themed books, including Does It Fart? Was probably our biggest hit.
Is it interesting to see which one of those is going to be? Because we're going to talk about that in a minute, but it was interesting to see which one was the hit out of those three books that you did.
Yeah, I think the first one was by far and away the most successful. I think just everyone loves farts. Everyone loves farts.
It's a weird one. I don't know why. They're always going to be funny. They're always going to be interesting. So, which is something we have to accept. That's awesome. So my first question is something I ask everyone that I have on the show. Because I'm always intrigued to see what kind of different answers we get. But how and when did your thirst for wildlife and nature begin for you?
So for me, it was really early. And I grew up in Birmingham, so it's a big city. I didn't grow up really around that much nature that wasn't urban nature. But through kind of watching TV and my mum and dad taking me to the local zoos in the area, so at the time that was Twycross and Dudley Zoo, I really ended up having a love for animals, really nurtured. And I think when I was about three, I'd already decided that I wanted to be a marine biologist, which was a bit ridiculous because I just watched so many shows on TV about animals and particularly about marine life, and I used to run around saying my favourite animal was a crab and making weird crab pincer with my hands. So yeah, like really early, and yeah, mostly through TV and zoos. Those were really important resources for me.
Awesome. And you mentioned at the beginning there you've written three books. You wrote a book called, your first one being Does It Fart, then you've got you wrote True or Poo, which I'm going to say I've got that book. Actually, I got that purchased for me a couple of years ago. And then it was last year you released Believe It or Snot?
Yeah, it was in October last year that Believe It or Snot came out, yeah.
And you mentioned in the intro there's a bit of a theme with these books. And are you intrigued by the slightly more gross side of nature?
I really like talking about that because I think in the UK in particular, we really have this, like, nature's so beautiful, this kind of Victorian ethos of nature kind of written into our culture almost. And so I find it really enjoyable to talk about all the disgusting things going on. I really enjoy those stories where they're like, oh, the animal was stuck, and then, you know, the baby elephant was stuck in the mud, and then a hippo came and rescued it. But then actually it's like, oh, I was just trying to eat it. It was just a side effect, really. So, yeah, I think those kind of things I've always found, I think a lot of people find them quite entertaining. Yeah. And it's kind of, some of the more interesting animal behaviours are truly disgusting.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. So what your first one with Does It Fart, why did you go with that kind of angle for your first book?
Yeah, so that was very organic, really. That came out of a discussion on Twitter where basically my brother asked if snakes farted, and I didn't know. So I reached out to David Steen, a snake expert on Twitter, and then that's when Nick, who's my co-author, chimed in and said we should make a hashtag. And obviously, as scientists, we then turned it into a spreadsheet where scientists could look up which animals fart, which animals don't. And then that kind of hit the media. I got invited to on Canadian TV, so I went to the studio in Camden and got projected in front of the Houses of Parliament talking about animal farts. So that was good fun. And yeah, so in the midst of all that was when our publisher came to us and said, "Oh, do you want to turn this into a book?" And we were like, "Yes, this is amazing." We were both graduate students at the time, so yeah. Number one, it sounded really fun, and number two, they were going to pay us, so yeah. We just did a bit mad to turn it down, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Can we pay you to do something? Absolutely, yes. That's fine. can we get the answer to that question? Do snakes fart?
So, in the words of David Steen. Sigh. Yes.
This is. I think this is going to be a book that I do purchase as well now. do you find focus on these kind of gross sides of nature, or the more disgusting side of nature? Do you find focusing on that kind of information is a good way to draw people into the world of wildlife as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think sometimes nature writing on natural history can be a bit dry. Yeah. Let's be honest. I think trying to be a bit more humorous with it and trying to talk about a bit more gross stuff, especially kids love it, but then there's a decent subsection of adults that love it too. I always say, like, draw people in with the farts and then hit them with the science.
It's true though. I mean, I come from a zoo background, and it is that kind of thing. You have to draw them in with the I'm sorry, what? And like the weird and the quirky, and then hit them at the end with, oh, by the way, this is very important. So it's kind of that draw, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And actually, I've had a lot of inquiries about various animal fart contributions to climate change, which kind of overlaps with my other research as well. So it's been quite interesting to see what's come out of it in terms of people asking genuine scientific questions out of a book that, you know, is about farts, really.
Yeah. I was going to ask what some of your favourite facts were from your second book, True or Poo. Do you have some favourites?
I do have an awful lot of favourites. I think True or Poo was really when we peaked in disgustingness. We'd done the whole of Does It Fart, and our publishers hadn't really batted an eyelid, but the one thing that got them to say, oh, is this a bit too disgusting to include, was in True or Poo, when basically a lot of animals, in order to, specifically herbivores, to get the gut flora needed to digest plant materials from their parents, they have to eat their poo. And elephants have actually been noted reaching, the baby elephant has been noted reaching into its mother's butt and
what?
Then pulling out a sloppy mouthful of poo. So yeah, that's what broke my publishers. It Jeez. Did get in though. It did
that make
book.
It in? I thought it was just Bear Grylls that had done stuff like that, but elephants are doing it as well. Jesus. God, that is a step for nutrients, isn't it? Jesus. That is pretty gross. But I will
very
say...
Very glad people don't have to do that. Very glad.
Oh, Jesus. I mean, I walk dogs day to day and I see them do it to each other as well. So it's not just elephants. Let's not just shame them.
They are.
I will say, True or Poo is a great book. Someone bought it for me a couple of years ago as a Christmas present. And then I ended up reading through it and I was like, this is incredible. This is my kind of book. So I do, anyone listening now, check it out. It is a really great book to go through. You also said what you focus on with African wild dogs, and this is something I'm really excited to talk about. We've spoken about wild dogs on the show before. You completed a PhD focusing on the impact of climate change on African wild dogs, specifically behavioural changes. Now, this is a very broad question. The first one I guess I'll ask is, why the focus on African wild dogs? What was the draw in there?
So basically, when I started a PhD, and the kind of format of that was that we got the money and then we went out and found a project. So it's a different route to most people, where I didn't ever really think that I'd been working on large mammals previously. I'd mostly worked on bats. It was a really cool project, and when I met my supervisor, we got on really well, and it had a lot of the elements that I was looking for: a bit of field work, a lot of kind of quantitative work. Those were the kind of skills I was looking to build on. And I knew the field site because I'd done work there before, not on African wild dogs. So that was kind of what led me to that project in particular. But the reason that that project ended up focusing on African wild dogs is because we have this amazing 18 years now data set out of ZSL from a long-term site in Laikipia as part of the Kenya Rangelands Wild Dog and Cheetah Project. And those kind of long-term data sets are just absolutely great for looking at these kind of climate change impacts, temperature impacts. They're really essential for that. So I guess the long and the short of it wasn't really necessarily anything to do with the species, but the fact that we had so much data.
Yes, yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And this was the broad question that I was going to ask. And even when I wrote this question down to plan it, I was like, I think Danny might hate me asking this because it's such a broad thing, but what were the main findings from this study that you did?
Yeah, so it kind of went in stages. So the thing we know so far about the impact are when it's hot, wild dogs are crepuscular, so they're active in the morning and they're active in the evening, but in the day they just lie around. The day is when it's really hot. So when the weather's hot, they have shorter periods when it's cool enough to hunt. So that means they're spending less time hunting. And we also see that in hot weather, fewer pups survive to 12 months, so the recruitment is lower. And we also, there are links to adult mortality. So what I was able to do was to put those into a model. We can't grab an African wild dog and heat it up in the lab like you can with some animals. So I have to do it on a computer. I have to simulate some wild dogs on the computer. So I can kind of put my wild dog population in and see what happens and see at what temperatures the population collapses. So that's kind of where we're at, really, trying to get that work published, which is exciting.
And
but
that's still
also
an ongoing,
quite sad news in many cases.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. And that's still an ongoing process, is it, collecting that data and putting that in?
I mean, the data's analysed, just writing it up and putting it into journals, and then we can yell about it a bit more widely. But I think so far the papers we've had out are on reproduction and behaviour, and kind of those impacts on the wild dogs. And then we did a lot of things along the way on things like wild dog dispersal, which weren't really linked to temperature, but we had to understand in order to be able to build these models.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. And along with climate change having an effect on wild dog populations, what other challenges do these animals face in the wild?
So wild dogs, actually, the climate change is far from the main threat. And the only reason that climate change is a problem for them is because they've lost so much habitat. So these days they're at 7% of their historic range.
And
there's less than 700 packs left in the wild, which equates to less than 700 breeding pairs. And this has come about through habitat loss, but also direct killings by people. You know, not even that long ago, these animals were treated as vermin by landowners and shot. So that didn't help. And then also just lack of available habitat. Fencing is a problem. It stops them dispersing. And then also disease, which they get from domestic dogs, is a real problem, in particular rabies and canine distemper.
Yeah. So that's easily spread from domestic dogs from there, just is easily spread onto the packs themselves as well.
So we see also have some issues with animals like lions picking these up. Obviously, wild dogs are more closely related to domestic dogs, and because of the fact they live in packs, once the pack gets it, it kind of spreads to all the members. So it's a really big problem in African wild dogs. We've had some really bad problems, particularly with canine distemper over the last few years.
And is there anything being done currently? I'm sure there are organisations set up, but what kind of efforts are we seeing get put in place to tackle these issues?
So with regards to disease, actually, there's a great program in Laikipia, the Laikipia Rabies Vaccination Scheme, and that goes out and vaccinates domestic dogs against rabies. And that's great because it keeps the wild dogs safe from rabies, but it also keeps people safe from rabies. So obviously rabies is a huge human health issue. So that's one of the best things, because it doesn't just protect the wild dogs, but it protects human health too, which is a kind of a win-win situation. And then other than that, it's things along the lines of helping people with herding practices so that their livestock aren't getting eaten, so that they're not doing retaliatory killings against the dogs, keeping areas of land protected, working on establishing how fencing is affecting them and how you can minimise those impacts. So these are the sort of conservation interventions that are going on across Africa.
Amazing. And it is something you mentioned there, which I always, whenever we talk about endangered animals or help for animals in the wild, it's something that always comes up is usually your first part of course is to encourage or to help the people around the animals first, because that's usually the impact on the animals, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. You know, if it's not surprising that if I rely on sheep and goats for my livelihood, and then African wild dogs eat all my sheep and goats, that I want to kill those animals,
yeah,
because then they're not going to be able to eat any more of them. So by helping people to prevent that happening without killing the wild dogs, that can reduce the conflict.
Yes.
So that's really important. And it's things like, for example, our research group, Rosie in particular, found that if you're going to send out a child to herd your sheep and goats, don't send two, because they get really distracted and then it's really easy for the wild dogs to come in and eat the sheep and goats. So if you're going to send a child, only send one. And it is really things like that can really help reduce these livestock deaths.
Absolutely. Those tiny differences, tiny changes to structure and routine, I guess. Talking on climate change, focusing back on that as well, obviously, I say the word obviously, but in my bubble, it's been in the media a lot, and we know it's got huge impacts on pretty much everything that goes on the planet. But when we look at wildlife, where's the most dramatic and drastic changes that we're seeing on the planet at the moment?
So I think, you know, it is correct to say that the Arctic is really suffering. But more broadly, there's animals all over the place. It will depend on the species characteristics, how animals are impacted.
Yeah.
And for animals like crepuscular animals in particular, they're really reliant on these very short periods for their activity. So I suspect that we might see them being harder hit because a lot of them aren't able to be nocturnal because they can't see well enough, or there are predators at night preventing them being nocturnal. Mm. But then the day is too hot, so they're kind of stuck between a bit of a rock and a hard place. So, I think we're going to see global issues, but, yeah, the Arctic is really going to be an issue as those ice sheets melt, because animals are so reliant on those areas. But any species that's had significant habitat loss is going to face problems because they've got nowhere to move to.
Yeah.
It's habitat loss that causes a lot of the problems with climate change because it stops them shifting with the climate. You know, if there's no other habitat that's going to remain a suitable climate, then that's when you see these localized and even species-wide extinctions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's true, I guess, isn't it? Especially when animals, you know, they're so uniquely adapted to their environment, and if that changes and there is nowhere else to go on to, it makes it extremely hard. Do you think places like the Arctic, and again, this is a broad question, so I apologise for keeping it so broad, but do you think places like the Arctic can go back to what it once was, even though the changes have been made? Do you think it's a case of more stopping where it is now, rather than trying to get back?
Yeah, well, I think it's not really possible some people suggest that large-scale greening or some sort of carbon capture might be able to improve things, but at the moment we're not even really stopping where we are, so it seems somewhat unrealistic to return to how things were when it seems almost impossible to even stop the impacts at where they are now. I think basically we just need to be reducing the harm as much as possible. Reversing it seems a very long way off.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we covered my next question, we've kind of covered with animals there. I was going to ask, you know, do we think that animals, no matter what the species, are going to be able to adapt and change? But I guess, like you said, that depending on their environment that they rely on. But if we look at humans themselves, do you reckon we're going to be able to adapt to the changes that are yet to come?
Yeah, I mean, some people, there are areas that aren't going to be hit as badly. You know, in richer countries, they have the money to buffer a lot of these climate change impacts. But then we're also going to see in less well-off countries and countries which are going to be worse hit by these climatic changes, then people don't have the money or access to the space to be able to adapt, you know.
Yeah.
Just as with animals, how habitat loss can mean that they've got nowhere to move to. We live in a world with borders, and if the people can't just migrate en masse to areas with better climate. So it means that countries have to adapt in place, and not every country has the resources to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess like you said there, it's, in many ways, it's exactly the same as the problems that the animals face. It's environment-based as well, and it's not being able to move from one place to another to strive, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there are technologies and there are things we can do to help mitigate climate change impacts, but it's going to require a really large-scale global effort to ensure that people can adapt, and whether the world kind of steps up to that, that is remains to be seen, I guess. It's something that all of us in climate sciences are working towards, but we've just got to try our best and hope that people agree to work together, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My last question to you is again, this is a Into the Wild question that we ask everyone that's on the show. But if you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone on the planet regarding nature and wildlife, what would you pass on?
I think what I would pass on is that human welfare and the welfare of the natural world are intrinsically linked. And if we want to help the planet, we have to help people too. And we have to enable other people to help the planet. But also, we have to look to ourselves. And, you know, in the UK, we're very lucky, because it's a very rich country. But also, we have one of the worst footprints. So it's really about holding your own country to account, but also enabling other people to look after and protect nature where they are as well.
Absolutely. And do you think that a big part of that is also making sure that nature and wildlife is accessible to everyone in order to create that?
Yeah, 100%. You've got to allow people to enjoy and value nature. If nature is harmful to them, which it is harmful to many people, if you look around the world, you've got areas where people are being killed by predators, being killed by large herbivores, being killed by mosquitoes, and you can't really sit back and be like, it's a privilege to be able to sit back and just enjoy nature rather than having it threaten your livelihood or worse, threaten your life. Yeah. So we need to enable people to appreciate nature, but also within our own countries, we need to allow people to access nature and enjoy nature. You know, in the UK, for example, at home here, we can do things by helping people to access nature. It's particularly difficult for ethnic minorities, for example, to gain access to nature and spend time in nature and access hobbies such as bird watching or hiking. So I think just creating an environment where people can do that, calling on environmental charities to bring in programs that support those kind of things. We're very bad at this sort of thing in the UK.
Yeah,
and a lot of our charities here don't have many of these or any of these programs. So I think that's something that at a local scale level we really should be pushing for, because we're not going to protect nature until people care about nature. Mm-hmm. And people aren't going to care about nature unless they have access to it.
Yeah, and I wholeheartedly agree on that. And that's something that I think, especially in the current time, something that I hope is not just taken away from responsibility of the public, but I think people have learned how important it is, so that we now know how important it is a human right to have access to it. I think in the current times of what's happened, that screams volumes for me, and I think that's hopefully something that's going to be taken away. Well, Danny, look, thank you so much for joining me on today's show. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, no worries at all. Thanks ever so much for having me.
Thanks again for tuning in to Into the Wild. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Danny is working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Rabbiotti. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify and Podbean. You can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod. Until next time, keep well, stay safe and live the good life.